Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our coverage of the gun violence epidemic in this country by speaking with two former white supremacists and a man who says he would have been a school shooter if he had access to a gun. And I just want to issue a warning that we will talk about some disturbing content today that is not appropriate for children. Last year, one of today's guests, Aaron Stark, wrote a widely read essay in the Washington Post called "I Would Have Been a School Shooter If I Could Have Gotten a Gun." He says he grew up in a chaotic and violent household, and after failing to get help, he snapped. He writes, quote, "I tried to get a gun. I wanted to take out as many people as possible, people who had tortured or ignored me, and then kill myself. It was 1997, and I had two possible locations mapped out, my school and a mall food court. I wanted to be heard. The abuse I'd suffered had closed me off, and I wanted to feel an emotion other than pain. I wanted to feel, for once, like I was in control, even if that meant spreading destruction and death." Aaron Stark now speaks about his experience. He is an author and a single dad, and he says it is very important to point out that there is no way to stereotype a shooter. Hi, Aaron. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to be with you. Only I'm not a single dad. I'm married. My wife would get really mad about that one.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I read that in a bio, and we should have double checked because sometimes those bios get it wrong. Thank you. We're also joined by Shannon Foley Martinez. Shannon describes herself as a former violent white supremacist. She entered the world of violent white supremacy when she was just 14 and spent nearly 5 years as a neo-Nazi. She has been disengaged for 25 years. She's now the mom of seven and works to prevent people from entering the world of white supremacy. Shannon is program manager of the Free Radicals Project. That's a nonprofit that helps disengage people from extremism. Hi, Shannon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And in my bio, I was actually 15. When I entered the movement.
All right, we need to do a better job of checking bios. Thank you. Thank you. Arno, let's hope we get your bio right. Arno Michaelis, he became involved in the white power movement at the age of 17 and was a founding member of what became the largest racist skinhead organization in the world. He was also a reverend for the Racial Holy War Group. He was a white supremacist for 7 years. Today, Arno is a speaker and author of the book, My Life After Hate. He founded an organization of the same name, which helps guide men and women away from violent far-right extremism. Hi, Arno. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. My bio is fine, although I was a reverend in a racial holy war. It's important to have the time sense in there, and that's no longer my current position.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, thank you all for joining us. So what I want to do on the show is I feel like a lot of people are saying it's really important to call these shooters terrorists. But I feel that we really need to understand who they are, what motivates them, and what it will take to stop them. And I hope that you can all help us understand and maybe try to answer some of these questions. Because the really important work you do today is to try to ensure that young people do not go down that path. So before we do that, though, I'd love to hear about your stories, and I know we can spend an entire hour with each of you. But let's start off with you, Aaron, because you write a lot about your childhood in this Washington Post piece. What was it about your childhood that left you vulnerable?
It was a combination of a lack of attention from my parents and their own chaos and destruction. They were heavily drug addicted, lots of violence, lots of extreme horror everywhere. And then that combined with constant moving around to new schools. I was constantly a new kid everywhere I went. So there was bullies everywhere. And I just internalized that. I was told I was worthless all the time. And I made that my whole persona, that I was going to be the bad guy.
And you actually tried to get help, and you had a really bad experience. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was suicidal. I was sleeping in my friend's shed, cutting myself. I was decided that I needed to get some help. So I got called social services for myself, set up a meeting on my own, and then I arrived but they didn't just bring me in. They also brought in my mom, who happened to be one of the largest sources of my abuse. And she got them to send me home with her after I even produced a bloody razor blade, told them that I was going to hurt myself, told them that I was in the middle of a really destructive space. And she got them to believe that I wasn't, I was all making it all up and it was just for attention. And then on the way home, she told me the worst sentence anyone's ever said to me my entire life, which was that I should have done a better job and she'll buy me the razor blades.
Oh, wow. What happened, Aaron, when you tried to get a gun?
That was actually really businesslike. There was gangbangers at this that went to my school. This was in the mid-90s, so gangs was really prevalent, and they had brought guns to the school on their own. They had like just showed off pistols and stuff to their friends, so I knew that they had access to them. And they knew that I was always at the school but never in the school. Like, they knew I wasn't a narc or anything, obviously. I was living in the park. And so I got some drugs from my druggy family. I stole some drugs from them. I went and bought a gun for an ounce worth of weed, and I was in a, I had to wait 3 days to get it. And luckily, within that 3 day time period, the only friend I had left in my life intervened, and just by treating me like a person when I didn't even feel like I was human, he stopped me from committing an atrocity.
It's amazing how it was just that one person who was able to stop you, and you're still friends with him today, right?
Yeah, he's still the best friend I've had in my life. We actually just went and saw a concert 2 days ago.
What was it? How did he get to you?
It was everybody else in my life, even the ones that were trying to help, were treating me like I wasn't a human. It was a project, or I was a problem. I was either a monster or I was something to be fixed. And he just sat me down. He was like, "Dude, you're okay. Hey, have a meal. You're not broken. You're not a monster. You're just a person going through a terrible life. The things you're feeling are normal feelings to have. You're really worth it." And to have him treat me with respect and actually notice me, and not to sit there and try to fix me, not try to make me a program, but just to respect me as a human and sit next to me, just to be in that place with me, it saved my life.
Wow. We'll talk about this more later in the show, but what advice would you give people who might know someone who seems troubled, that, you know, something's going on at home, they seem isolated, they seem angry, alone? What advice would you give people? What's the best way to reach out?
Just listen. Be the one person who's not going to give up on them when they freak out. Because when you are in that depression, you're going to lash out at everybody, especially the ones who care for you the most. You're going to try to destroy your world. You're going to try to burn everything down. And you need to be the one who's going to stick through that, who's not going to let your world get burned down and not going to let you get pushed away. Give love to the people who you think deserve it the least, because they need it the most.
That is Aaron Stark. He wrote a widely read essay in the Washington Post called "I Would Have Been a School Shooter If I Could Have Gotten a Gun." And Aaron now speaks about his experience. He is an author and a dad. He also says, and we're going to talk about this also later in the show, that there is no way to stereotype a shooter. That's really important. Today, we're also joined by Shannon Foley Martinez, who describes herself as a former violent white supremacist. She spent nearly 5 years as a neo-Nazi, and she's been disengaged for 25 years. So, Shannon, why don't you share your story with us? What was your childhood like, and did anything in your childhood leave you vulnerable?
Most people that grew up in the 1980s would recognize my childhood, but they probably grew up very similar to me. From the outside, everything looked pretty idyllic. My parents were upwardly mobile, middle class. I lived in a great neighborhood full of kids. But on the inside of my family, it was pretty dysfunctional. I did not grow up in a household of overt physical abuse. There was no drug or alcohol addiction that was prevalent in my family. But it was and did operate very codependently, which of course I didn't know at the time. I was just a child. But my earliest memories are those of not really fitting in my family. I always felt like the black sheep in my family. I always felt like I didn't quite belong there. We ended up moving halfway across the country when I was 11 years old, And that sense of not really belonging inside of my family expanded out into the greater world, because now I was an outsider, not just in my home, but also amongst my peers who had all grown up together and had known one another for their entire lives. And so I started looking to, like, counterculture to try to do what, you know, young adolescents do, trying to figure out who I was in the world. How do I make sense of who I want to be when I don't really feel like I fit in anywhere? One of my very first favorite books was actually the autobiography of Malcolm X. I loved the revolutionary nature of the ideas and the power with which he spoke. But I was living in the middle of the Midwest. There were, you know, my exposure to any sort of radical jihadist thought was, you know, was not non-existent. So I ended up gravitating towards the punk movement. And then just before I turned 15 years old, I went to a party where I was raped by two men. Because my entire childhood, my parents' first response to if I got hurt or if I was sick was to lash out, because they felt afraid and out of control. You know, that if I came with an injury, they were just like, how many times have we told you not to do that? What have we told you about doing that? Don't you know, like, how inconvenient this is or whatever? That was always their first response, played out again and again in my childhood. So I knew on some very deep level the next morning after these rapes happened that if I went to them, that I would be more in trouble for having lied about where I was going and having been drinking at this party than they would be upset that I had just been sexually assaulted. And so I think there was this protective part of me that was like, I knew that I couldn't take the additional trauma of the victim blaming that would come. But I didn't have anyone else to tell by that point either. I didn't have any other trusted adults in my life at that point. And so I just took all of that trauma completely unprocessed and shoved it down. And within about 6 months, I was just consumed with rage and anger that I didn't understand and I didn't know what to do with, and I had no idea how to process it. And it was shoved down so deeply that it would take me another 10 years just about to even be able to label what happened to me that night as rape. Hmm. That the way that I framed the story for myself was simply that I had lost my virginity to two men at a party when I was 14 years old. It wouldn't be until after the birth of my oldest son that I would come to the realization, like, I didn't lose my virginity to two men at a party. I was raped by two men at a party when I was 14 years old. And that was the beginning of a lot of understanding about the trajectory that my life took soon after that rape happened. So within about 6 months, I was so consumed with rage and anger, and the angriest people on the periphery of the punk scene where I hung out were the white supremacist skinheads. And I think the rage and anger that I felt really resonated with the rage and the anger that they displayed. And I began to spend more and more time hanging around with them, listening to music and reading some of the literature out there about the white supremacy movement. And I think this broken and twisted need set that I had, that I really, really needed to have a place where I felt like I could be a mess and still belong. I needed a place where it was okay to be really angry. And I needed a connection to something that felt at least like meaningful to me, and that I felt so deeply disempowered, and I felt so afraid of everything in the world that the white supremacist viewpoint offered me at least this convenient sort of illusion of or explanation for why I felt under threat and afraid all of the time. And it also gave me a chance to project outward the self-hatred that I felt so deeply out onto other people.
Hmm.
I would eventually end up, over the course of those 5 years, moving all over the country and living with white supremacists all over the country. And eventually I would end up without a place to go. Very luckily for me, I was going out with a guy who was also in the white supremacy movement, who happened to be in the Army and still in training. So I couldn't go live with him. But his mom agreed to let me come live with her. And she was a single mom and had three other younger sons. And she very courageously and compassionately chose to see me as a hurting and struggling young woman rather than this, you know, hate-filled and vile creature that I had become. And, you know, and she took me into her home and provided me with a sense of family and belonging and genuine unconditional acceptance, and those things that she offered me created enough space around me for me to be able to shift and begin to examine what it was that my life had become and think about, like, how did I get here? How has this hate and dehumanization of other human beings become my life? And, you know, and she did some other things as well, you know, but mostly that she began the process of rehumanizing me.
Wow.
Much like Aaron talks about, that it was, she chose to very deeply see me as a human worth investing in, rather than just see the hate-filled actions that I was spewing out into the world.
Do you think you would have stayed in the movement if it hadn't been for that woman who reached out to you?
I think I probably would have at least stayed in longer.
Right.
Yes.
That is Shannon Foley Martinez. She describes herself as a former violent white supremacist. She spent nearly 5 years as a neo-Nazi. Today, we're also joined by Arno Michaelis, and he became involved in the white power movement at age 17. What about you, Arno? You describe your childhood in a number of interviews, saying that your dad was an alcoholic and your mom was really suffering, and her suffering made you suffer. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting contrast between Aaron and Shannon and myself. And Aaron and Shannon, my heart goes off to both of you for what you guys went through, because I know how hard it is. And I honestly don't know it from personal experience, because my childhood was absolutely idyllic compared to either of those stories. I grew up in a nice house, a nice neighborhood, suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My parents were married. They both loved me very much, and they let me know that in return, as did all the adults in my life. In fact, I was really, like, fawned upon as a kid, and, like, this golden boy. He's so gifted. He's so wonderful. He's such a genius. He could do whatever he wants to do. He's so bright. But Monday morning psychoanalysis, looking back on my childhood from my perspective now, I think what was happening was, because of my mother's suffering, which was really because of my father's alcoholism, and he wasn't abusive. He was kind of a fun drunk. When dad was drunk, we're going to shoot off fireworks and light up, shoot guns. Like, that's what could be more fun for a little boy in America than that. But so he wasn't, like, abusive to my mom or abusive to me, but the drinking meant that he did more drinking than working, and that put a lot of pressure on my mom, who at times worked two jobs, keep the household running. And her relationship with my dad sucked. They were constantly fighting about bills, about financial pressures, about his drinking, and I could really sense my mom suffering, and that hurt me. And rather than be a good kid and say, hey mom, I'm sorry you're suffering, I love you, how can I help, I started to distance myself from her and from my dad, who also loved me very much despite the disease he struggled with. And as I distanced myself from the people who could have helped me, I suffered more, and I started hurting other kids. So I was a bully on the school bus as early as kindergarten. I started to get a real kick out of causing trouble, and it became very much like an addiction, especially in the sense of the escalating amount of the substance required to get the same kind of buzz. So bullying on the school bus gets old, so now I get a whole crew of kids to bully the same kid. That gets old, so I start getting in fights in the schoolyard, and then it goes from there to vandalism, burglary, breaking and entering. By the time I'm 14, I start drinking myself. By the time I'm 16, I'm a full-blown alcoholic. I have been violent since I'm a little kid. I'm familiar with violence. I convince myself that I like violence, that I like to get hit. And hate was just another part of the rush, just to say I hate you to my parents and to the school and to society and the cops and the government. It fulfilled that same kind of adrenaline habit that I had that was addressed by lashing out. And that's who I was when I heard White Power skinhead music, which told me I was a warrior fighting for my race, which is under assault from this Jewish conspiracy to kill all the white people on the planet Earth, and it's my job to stop them. And as ridiculous as that sounds to any thinking person, to 16-year-old Arno, it was like literally music to my ears. And best of all, it really pissed people off. Like, I had a lifelong habit of pushing the boundaries of society and trying to find the way to piss off the most people at once. Well, nothing does that like a swastika. And that was the big attraction for me that got me involved in White Power skinheads.
Arno, in interviews, you've said that you and the people that you were involved with violently attacked people of other races and religions about once a week for 4 or 5 years. What was going through your head when you were hurting people?
Well, it's an interesting question, because that was actually part of the exhaustion that let me out. When people ask me how I got out, the one word answer is exhaustion. And the exhaustion came from all sorts of directions, but the prime direction of it came from an inner voice that sometimes would be pleading and screaming with me as I'm hitting someone, saying, "What are you doing? Like, what's wrong with you? Why are you attacking this innocent person? Like, you're a horrible person." And I didn't have the courage to even acknowledge that voice, much less answer it. So I'm constantly expending energy to flee from this very deep inner knowledge of my wrongness. And looking back again in Monday Morning Psychoanalysis, I think my entire problem was really fleeing from my suffering and not having the courage to say, like, I don't feel good. I'm hurting. I need help. Something's wrong. And I think that's a very common thing for men all over the world. And I think that's a big reason why gender is a huge factor in violent extremism, I think much more so than race or any other sort of denominator.
Before we go to break, Arno, you also have an interesting story about when you used to go to McDonald's and you met an older African-American woman who treated you very warmly and nicely when she took your order. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is actually early on in my 7 years of White Power skinhead, and I had gotten a swastika tattooed on my middle finger strategically so that when people reflected my hostility, I could show them that swastika with the middle finger before making a fist and hitting them. And so it was literally like a permanent mark on my body to repulse people and to hurt people. And as I walked into this McDonald's, there's this elderly black woman behind the counter taking orders, and I was kind of stunned by her smile just walking in the door. She had this beautiful, genuine smile that was just like there for everyone. It was like the sun. The sun shines on everybody. Doesn't care what color your skin is, how much money you got, or how your politics are. It just shines. And that's how her smile was. And it made me really uncomfortable, because it kind of blew all of my nonsense out of the water just on its own. But ultimately, the siren song of the Big Mac prevailed, and I approached the counter. And I was thinking, I didn't want her to see that tattoo. That was also kind of an almost involuntary thing, where even I got the tattoo to repulse black people, anyone of color, to repulse Jewish people, because of her grace and her smile. Like, I almost instinctively could not show her that tattoo, so I figure I'm going to keep my hand in my pocket the whole time, not thinking that I got to get money out of my pocket, and as I'm trying to do that without showing the back of my hand, she saw the tattoo. And she said to me, much like my grandma would say to me when I was beating up my little brother, with the same kind of like look, she just said, "What is that on your finger?" And I couldn't answer her. I just like stared down at my steel-toed skinhead boots, and I was a good foot taller than her at that time, but I felt about 6 inches high, and all I could say was, "It's nothing." And she waited until I looked up again, and when I looked up and our eyes met, she just said, I know that's not who you are. You're a better person than that." And I just said, can I have my payback, please? I got my food, and I went running out of there. I literally, like, fled from her kindness and her compassion and her forgiveness, because it completely threw me for a loop. It was completely incongruous to everything I was trying to believe. And it was 7 years later that the seed that she planted finally came to fruition. And the exhaustion had built to a point where I was, like, looking for an excuse to leave the movement. And I honestly believe if it wasn't for her kindness, as well as for my parents' dedication to me, who never gave up on me and said they always loved me and have a place to go, and for the kindness of other people, like a Jewish boss or a lesbian supervisor or Black and Latino coworkers, I don't know where I'd be today. I think I might be dead or in prison. And so every single day, I'm grateful to not live that life anymore. I'm grateful for this woman at McDonald's bravery, and I'm grateful for the human capacity for kindness.
Wow. That is Arno Michaelis. He became involved in the White Power movement at age 17. He was involved for 7 years. He's now a speaker and author of the book My Life After Hate, and he does really incredible work today to help guide men and women away from violent far-right extremism. We're joined also by Shannon Foley Martinez, a former white violent supremacist. She is now program manager of the Free Radicals Project. They also help people disengage from extremism. And Aaron Stark. He writes and talks about his experience. He had a great piece in the Washington Post called I Would Have Been a School Shooter If I Could Have Gotten a Gun. And we wanted to get Aaron, Shannon's and Arno's stories out. After the break, we will talk to them about, just ask them to help us understand what motivates these young men who kill. How can we reach them before they carry out these massacres? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you may email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. A World Without Water is the topic of discussion on 1A, coming up in a half hour here on KALW at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of the horrific massacre in El Paso, Texas. The LA Times' Esmeralda Bermudez will talk about the impacts of this horrific tragedy on the Latino community. And Reveal's Will Carlos and The Guardian's Jason Wilson will discuss the role that the media play in covering the rise of white supremacist terrorism and extremism here in the U.S. and around the globe. Today, we really think so hard about how we should cover this, and we've really covered all angles. And we thought a good way to try to understand these young shooters and try to understand how to stop them before they kill would be to bring on people who are former white supremacists, Shannon Foley Martinez and Arno Michaelis, and Aaron Stark, who wrote a piece in the Washington Post called I Would Have Been a School Shooter If I Could Have Gotten a Gun. So I wish we had 2 hours, because I really thought it was important to get your experience out. But in the next section of the show, I'd love you all to jump in, and if you'd like to talk to each other. Aaron, to start, you make a really good point in saying you cannot stereotype the shooters. You cannot put them in one box. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I really think that people generalize. We have this problem where we label things, and then we just think that's going to generalize everything, and we put things into boxes. And I think people are trying to do that now with this, well, do we label it terrorism? Well, technically that doesn't even have any legal recourse right now, because there's no domestic terror statute. It's all just rhetoric. And when we do that, we can depersonalize it even more. We need to stop putting labels on the person and see the human, because there's not a stereotype of where this pain comes from. It's just pain. You could see it in the differences in the stories between the three of us, because it seems like there's a huge spectrum of both upbringing and outlook of where we start. But at the heart of it, what saved us all from causing that destruction was simple kindness and love. And I think that if once we start to see the humanity of these people, instead of just looking at them as the shooter or the angry white male or the stereotype that we see, the same way that we want them to see us, we want the white supremacist to see the Latino as a human and not just as the immigrant invader.
And you know, what's so hard about that is, in the case of the El Paso shooter, I mean, we're learning that he specifically went to that area to shoot Mexicans.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And he fits into what the stereotype would seem, that it's the angry white male. But when I read his manifesto, I saw a strong parallel between my own story of wanting to use that darkness that I was living in as a shield and as a weapon. Like, you hate yourself so much that you want to make the whole world agree with you. And then you do everything you can to make that a reality. And so you internalize the fact that you're the terrible person. And then you combine that with social media, where now instead of having a bully that might have three or four bullies on his side that'll cheer him on, but you'll have four or five other people that'll tell him, hey, you're a bully, knock it off. Now you have social media where there's a whole subculture of people that'll not only give him tips on how to be a better bully, but basically cheer him on and reward them for being the best troll or bully. And that becomes positive reinforcement that they've been craving this whole time, that all they wanted to do is feel validated and feel like they matter and feel like they're worth it. But they get it from being the most destructive thing possible.
Right. And then add to that, in so many parts of the country, it's very easy to get your hands on a military-style assault weapon.
Yeah, yeah, it's both sides of it. That the fact that you can easily, that these last shootings, that kid got his AR-15 or the whatever the rifle that looked like it off the from a legal sale like a week before.
Yeah.
And go ahead,
Shannon. What would you add?
Well, I mean, America has a really tenuous history with violence, right? So, I mean, our entire nation is predicated on violence. We began with a violent revolution. We genocided an entire continent. We built our nation on the backs of people that we violently enslaved. And then even though we freed them, we violently enacted systems of oppression. We've been at war most of our existence as a nation. So we have a real deeply entrenched history of utilizing violence to solve our problems. And I think that is something that we have to come to terms with. In terms of this last week of mass shootings, there is a difference between ideologically motivated violence and violence that happens to be carried out by someone who has a particular ideological viewpoint. And I do think that it is important to make a distinction and to understand the networks that exist behind them and support those systems. And that matters for how we can better disrupt some of the trajectory towards catastrophic violence. I think overwhelmingly, young people feel really afraid of the future, that they see climate catastrophe looming. They see an educational system that will bring them massive amounts of debt, but not necessarily a meaningful education, and certainly not any job security, as automation comes more and more into play, and they overwhelmingly don't feel like anyone is listening to those fears that they have. That I have actually found that most young people are desperate to engage and grapple with the big ideas that are confronting us as a nation. But instead, we spend our time squabbling over whether to impeach or not impeach, or this person is president now and aren't they so awful, and this other person is president now and aren't they so awful. And so there's this very real sense where there is a real lack of agency that young people feel. And the only people that are really that really seem to be listening right now, and that create a space, are spaces where they're talking about conspiracy theories, and they're talking about far-right ideologies, or they're talking about more empowered masculinity. And so the messages that are available for people that really want to engage in these ideas are overwhelmingly those that give in to and really lean on the ideas of violence and destruction and hopelessness. And so those of us that are fighting against this, that we must do a better job of engaging and listening and hearing the grievances and the desires to engage in meaningful discussion about those grievances. The other thing that I think is really important, and it's difficult to talk about because, yes, the studies about mental health and shooters, they're pretty clear that there is no link. However, some of that has to do with what we see as things that that affect mental health, that overwhelmingly in the work that I do, that I believe that we actually live in a pandemic of trauma, that we live in a time where trauma is affecting everyone, that there is individual trauma, there is systemic trauma, there is the trauma of living in a white supremacist system. There's complex trauma that we don't recognize yet, and I think that we must do a better job of recognizing that and responding in trauma-informed and trauma-responsive ways when we see young people, when they're very young, exhibiting negative behaviors and responding rather than punishment, what is this behavior trying to tell us? How can we connect you with what you need to heal and find pro-social ways to respond?
And Arno, when we think about what Shannon just laid out about economic anxiety, about anger because college is unaffordable and it's hard to find a good job, what happens when you add in racism and extreme hate to all of that? I'm thinking about Dylan Roof, who shot and killed 9 black people at a church in Charleston in 2015. I'm thinking about the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. The 46-year-old man attacking the Tree of Life synagogue, the shooting in El Paso where this shooter went after Mexicans. What happens when you start at that point of being angry about what's happening in your life and then adding in the racism?
Well, violent extremist groups of any sort, and this point needs to be emphasized, really to Aaron's point, is that it's there's no particular demographic that's more or less susceptible to this. They're all looking for a dry pile of smoking tinder to throw a match on. And in the case of white nationalism, they're absolutely going to prey upon any kind of economic uncertainty, and they will racialize it. Interestingly, in an exact mirror image of far-left rhetoric, they'll basically say, instead of this all being white people's fault, this is none of our fault. We white people have done all these good things, and now we're being persecuted because of it. And it's essentially a victimhood narrative, as is the jihadist ideology, as is political rhetoric from either pole. The further you get to the pole, the more victimhood-oriented it becomes. And the victimhood, to Shannon's point, exacerbates existing trauma. And you get yourself in a trauma loop where, much like my childhood, you have your source trauma, you isolate because of it, the isolation increases the trauma, and then you lash out and the trauma keeps happening. So that's what's happening here. And I also think it's really important for everybody, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, no matter what your socioeconomic background is to mindfully avoid avoid binary thinking. Mm-hmm. As Aaron pointed out, our society wants to be like, yes, there's a terrorist, he's not a terrorist. In a general sense, I agree with Aaron 1,000% that labeling people terrorists does not make our society any better. At the same time, in a non-binary way of thinking, because the jihadist terrorism has had that label for a long time, our government dedicates resources to it accordingly, for better or worse. There's horrible things happening in that regard where communities are being surveilled and it makes things worse, but there's also attacks that are being prevented. And having worked with every government agency you can name, as well as local law enforcement, I can tell you that the bulk of jihadist attacks nowadays are stopped before they happen because of the time and energy dedicated to them. The reason why I believe we're seeing this state of white nationalist attacks is because we're not dedicating that same amount of time and energy towards preventing those attacks, and we need to. We need to take white nationalism every bit as seriously as we take the so-called Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab et al. We have to take that seriously, and at the same time remind ourselves that white nationalists, as well as members of ISIS, are human beings. And at one time or another, they were beautiful, innocent three-year-olds that were as full of potential and beauty as any child ever was. And something went horribly wrong between that point and the point of attack or the point of radicalization. And that's what we need to look at. And to do that, we have to call people in rather than calling them out. I believe that these attacks, as well as the affinity for the ideology, they stem from a sense of rejection. Today, I work with a brilliant man named Pardeep Singh Kalika. Pardeep's father, Sutwant, was murdered 7 years ago this past Monday in the Sikh temple shooting by a guy who belonged to the gang that I helped to start. And Pardeep is a trauma therapist. He and I work together to run a program for young people called Serve to Unite that does arts-driven service learning and corporate engagement. And we were working in a school where we're connecting with student council, and they said, hey, there's a kid who walks down the hall with a Confederate flag as a cape. You know, what do we do about it? And we said, well, what's this kid like? Does he have a lot of friends? How's his life going? Is he popular? No. It's all bad. And Party realized something that I think is kind of key to this whole phenomenon. And Party said that this kid with the Confederate flag cape is like preemptively rejecting himself by attaching his identity to a repulsive symbol or repulsive ideology, and therefore he doesn't have to expose his vulnerability to say, hey, I'm afraid nobody likes me, Joe Smith. I'm afraid that Joe Smith isn't good enough. I'm afraid of this. I'm hurting. I need help. So rather than face those vulnerabilities, he adopts this symbol that he knows is going to repulse everybody, and then when they reject him, he could say, see, they were going to reject me all along. And now he's preemptively kind of addressed that issue without really addressing the issue. And that's what's happening here. So if we reject people, I think it's going to make the problem a lot worse. And by saying, like, this is a white male problem, it doesn't make any more sense than saying ISIS is a Muslim problem, and it's just as damaging. And so we need to be very careful to avoid that and remind ourselves that life is a very complex process and there's nuance to everything. And especially if something is striking our political cords and it's firing up our confirmation bias, that's especially when we need to question it and to think about complexity.
And to your point, Arno, about complexity, Shannon, Christian Picciolini, who founded the Free Radicals Project, who you worked with, tweeted, and this really caught my attention. He said, most might be horrified and confused to learn that I also regularly get emails from Jewish mothers disturbed by their son's swastika tattoo, Latinos subscribing to white supremacy, non-whites and LGBT folks who love Hitler. Hatred lends permission for anger to exist, not logic. And I think that really speaks to what Arno's talking about, that this has many layers to it.
So so much. Earlier this year, I had just spoken at an event, and I was in a bathroom at a restaurant, this black mother was in the bathroom with her 2-year-old little girl, and the two-year-old little girl had pizza like all over her face. And the mom was there, like, washing her off, and I was just like, oh, so adorable. And just moments later, I thought to myself, wow, you know, 25 years ago, I would have interpreted that scene completely differently. I would have not seen this endearing moment of this mom and this pizza-covered little girl. I would have seen them as a threat. And then I thought, I had this awakening that it was like so much of what I was doing was just trying to find an explanation for why I felt under threat and afraid all of the time. And that can take so many convoluted twists and turns. And I'm very hesitant to talk about the murders that happened over this last week as simply like white supremacy, you know, nationalism or whatever, because the ideologies of all of the shooters were very convoluted, and they are not really super straightforward and clear-cut, that there's lots of overlapping, that there's this complexity of trying to create a worldview to explain why they feel afraid and why they are the victim and how other people are the enemy to fight against, as well as the fact that we have a real, real danger when we talk about this to be like, those guys over there doing this bad stuff, those are the white supremacists, and aren't they bad? Rather than particularly as white people being like, I still, as a white person in America, have work to do, not through any fault of my own, but that I am still white in a white supremacist system, and I have got to continue to expose and look for and work on the ways that I even subconsciously participate in and uphold white supremacy. So we have to really not scapegoat white supremacy and the danger of white supremacy simply out onto the violent actors that are out there, that we all have work to do.
Shannon Foley Martinez is a former violent white supremacist, and Arno Michaelis became involved in the white power movement at the age of 17. Aaron Stark wrote a piece last year for the Washington Post, "I would have been a school shooter if I could have gotten a gun." We're unfortunately almost out of time, but let's take a call and then a couple of emails, and hopefully we'll have enough time to get your responses. Let's go to Tina in San Francisco. Hi, Tina.
I have a couple. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So I have a couple of questions regarding, in my own personal experience, I've had some experience with cults lately. There's all sorts of cults out there, Scientology, Mankind Project. I talked with a man named Rick Ross at the Cult Education Institute. They're all dangerous. And in the community that I'm out and about a lot, and I've met some young men who are confused, and they don't know what to... You know, and I can tell that they're going to be victims of these cults, and it's gotten to the point where it's like, see, if I see something on the telephone pole, says, are you lost? I tear it down, because I just feel like maybe I can save one life, or if I can talk to someone, that's even better. But if you could just, you know, kind of say you're worth it, or somehow say that without seeming like you're, you know, coming on to them, or, you know, you're just trying to make a statement in a spiritual way that they are God's child, they are, we are all created equally, and we are, and whatever, these people, these living beings who did this shoot, that was not the real them. The mass shooters, what they did was not the real them. But that being said, I feel that Trump is creating a stage where he is propagating this Make America Great Again, which essentially MAGA is a cult. It is a cult. If I think Rick Ross would agree with me.
Well, so, you know, to that point, Tina, and I'm sorry to cut you off. We are almost out of time. I do want to ask all of you, what effect Trump's racist comments and, say, Fox, the language we hear on Fox, and in fact, a lot of the language we hear on Fox was in the El Paso shooters manifesto. And I wish we had time for these clips, but I'd rather get your responses, because most of us have heard this very horrible rhetoric. Aaron, based on, you know, the young people you work with, what effect does Trump's language and the language we hear from Fox and their hosts and their guests have on people?
I think that it's having a terrible effect, but mostly on the older generation. I think that because I honestly don't know many young people that are huge Fox watchers. Mm-hmm. I know that it seems to be an older demographic, but that constant drumbeat of fear of the other, of xenophobia, of demonization of anybody that's different, and of the victimization of their own in-group, that everything is a problem that's attacking them, and it's always the fault of this other person over here. And that constant drumbeat is so repetitive that it's extremely damaging. But I think that the Fox problem is pale in comparison to the talk radio problem. The right-wing talk radio is so omnipresent. Mm-hmm. If someone is watching Fox and watching Sean Hannity, they can watch him for 2 minutes and he can they can watch his show. They can listen to him for 4 hours on the radio and talk back to him and interact. Mm-hmm. And it's this massive echo chamber of hate that starts to happen.
Arno, what would you add?
And we know from cognitive linguistics that the metaphors that are utilized to frame problems, so if you frame crime as a beast or you frame crime as a virus, and you utilize that metaphor in your messaging, that it directly affects the solutions that people offer to those problems. So the words that we hear and the way problems are framed and the language that is used, it directly impacts how people respond to those problems.
And Arno, what would you add? We're almost out of time.
I think it's, the rhetoric that comes from this administration is word for word the rhetoric of the El Paso Shooters Manifesto, as well as the Christchurch shooter, and as well as the Norway shooter back in 2011, and that's unacceptable. However, people need to be mindful that the far right does not exist in a vacuum. It depends on the far left to feed it, and therefore I really think people need to be about what they're for rather than what they're against. I get a label slapped on me all the time that I'm an anti-hate activist, I'm an anti-racist activist, and I see people call themselves anti-Trump. But when you're anti-whatever, you're defined by that thing, just logically. That's how it works. So rather than being anti-anything, I'm pro kindness, I'm pro compassion, I'm pro forgiveness, I'm pro human diversity, complexity, nuance, this beautiful existence that we share. Be about what you're for rather than what you're against, otherwise we're going to perpetuate the problem.
Well, I feel like we could speak for another couple of hours, and we've got a number of emails about, for example, misogyny in these hate groups, and I'd love to have you all back to really focus more on these issues and what it will take to actually reach these young people before they shoot and kill. Aaron Stark wrote an essay in the Washington Post last year, "I would have been a school shooter if I could have gotten a gun." Shannon Foley Martinez is a former violent white supremacist, and Arno Michaelis became involved in the white power movement at the age of 17. We also have some emails thanking you all for your work. So thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Anytime.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.